Okay, so we're going to be talking about tactics, and the subtitle, if you remember that PowerPoint slide, is how to discuss your Christian convictions, or rather, I know there was a little bit of confusion. Some people were thinking, oh, you know, am I going to learn how to talk about why don't I cuss, why don't I drink, stuff like that, or why don't, you know, some other thing. It's not quite that, really. I made a mistake in including the word convictions. I took it from the title of a book. Just think of it how to discuss your Christian beliefs. Basically, we're going to learn tonight how to efficiently navigate and start a conversation with a skeptic or maybe somebody in your family who's doubting. How to start that conversation and how to navigate through it, and ultimately how to kind of gain control of that conversation. Okay. And I want to start off with this verse that we see in the New Testament. Paul wrote to the Colossians chapter 4, verse 6, "Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each one." That is very key in any conversation that you get to, is take this to heart. Let your speech always be with grace. I'm sure if I could just ask for a show of hands, how many of you guys have gotten in an evangelistic conversation, especially with family members, and it just went haywire, got really aggressive, escalated really quickly, right? We've all been there. But Paul's saying here, let your speech always be with grace. It's going to take some self-control. It's going to take discipline. You're probably going to hate it at first, but through the power of the Holy Spirit, you can work on that and learn to have self-control and to have your speech be with grace with whomever you are conversing with. So for many Christians, getting into conversations, right? We know that there's a call on our life. In fact, I remember doing a study a couple of years ago. You can probably find it on the CSA website, is the call that every Christian has to go and give a reason, to go and make disciples. We have an evangelistic call on our lives as Christians. But for many of us, especially in this culture where people are just so aggressive, so turned off, and we have so many bad examples of how not to get in conversations, that makes us afraid. It makes us scared of starting a conversation, you know, with our coworkers or even a stranger at the bus stop or at the grocery store, parking lot, whatever. So there's a couple of reasons. You know, number one, some of us just have a shy personality in general, right? I tend to have that in certain circumstances. You're just shy. You're just like, it's awkward. You know, I don't know how to do it. Two, sometimes we're afraid of offending people. This is a big thing for us. We really want to we want to follow what Paul said, as much as possible, have peace with one another, have peace with your neighbor. We don't want to offend people. We don't want to cause disharmony in those relationships. Number three, maybe we've been in conversations before, like we raised our hands, and one or both people wound up getting angry. So we've had bad experiences in the past. And that just really turns us off for any future conversations. You're like, I'd rather not repeat that experience, all right? That's another reason we don't get in conversations. Lastly, we're afraid of not knowing what to say or not knowing the answer for any objection that's brought up. I think this is a big one. And that's why I encourage you guys, get grounded in that systematic theology. But also, this is why we're having this class, to build up that knowledge, all right? So I think we would all agree with these reasons, and we probably are all affected by one of these. Now, if you found yourself in any of situations, I believe you have, then this class is for you. It's going to help you tremendously. I'm not even kidding, guys. It's awesome. I'm not selling you anything on QVC or anything like that. Believe me, it's awesome stuff we're going to learn. As you'll come to see, anyone can use these tactics. In fact, they're geared towards people with limited knowledge and experience. This is a great thing about it. Essentially, the purpose is to help the Christian, new and seasoned Christian, to be confident in evangelism and stay in control of the conversations. Now, the material we're going to be going over tonight can be found in a book, as I mentioned right at the beginning. The book has the same name as the title of the class. So it's called Tactics, How to Discuss Your Christian Convictions. And I'll be giving a couple of copies away today in the raffle. It's a great short little book. I think it's like 100-some pages, I think. Really easy to get through, but chock full of great information, great advice. And it's awesome because if any of you have a Kindle, and Amazon, you know, they sell Kindle books. This book actually goes on sale periodically for like $2, $2-3. It's a steal of a deal, guys. If you're on like my Facebook friend, I make sure to post that link every single time that that book's on sale. It's great. So if you want to become my Facebook friend, you know, let me know. I will let you know, just to kind of put your mind at ease, is that these tactics are non-confrontational. In fact, they're based on the fact that, you know, like Paul said, let your speech always be with grace. So it kind of trades on the idea of having more of a genuine curiosity in that conversation rather than confrontation. All right? Just like Jesus, when he sent out his disciples, he said, I'm sending you out amongst wolves. And he tells them, be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. And so that's the kind of stuff we're going to be learning today. Now, what is the goal with tactics? I've already given you one, is to be in control of a conversation for sure. But ultimately, it's to put a stone in someone's shoe. And I really like that phrase. This is, you might have heard me say it before, and this is the book where I got it out of. But to put a stone in someone's shoe, what that means is when you have a conversation, ultimately, when that conversation ends, you want to leave that person that you spoke with, you want to leave them with something to think about, something they can't ignore because it just keeps poking at them, right? Just like a stone in your shoe, you're walking home, you're like, I feel it, I'm going to ignore it, but no, it keeps poking you. And finally, you got to address it. That's the ultimate goal of tactics. And you might see the implication here is that some of us, you know, growing up in a Christian environment, or you may have heard this, is that some people believe, you know, in whatever conversation you get into, especially evangelistic, you always have to aim at sharing the gospel with that person. Now, I'll let you know, I don't believe, you know, that's, first of all, I don't think it's possible to do that with every single conversation. And I don't think it's practical to do that with every single conversation. It's impossible, mainly because many times you have a very small window of opportunity. So you might even have like a 10-second window. Maybe somebody's getting off a bus, they see a book you're reading, and they ask you, and they have to go quickly. You know, what can you share with them in that very small window of opportunity that's of significance? If you just share the gospel with them, you might just go in one ear and out the other. It's impractical also to try to get to the gospel message in every single conversation, because for many encounters that we have, the person that we're dealing with, their heart may not be ripe. They may not be at the point where they're ready to receive the gospel and really understand it or really wrestle with it at that moment. Many people are probably at a point where they just reject it outright. You know, so that's why I believe, you know, it's worth at least having a goal, especially with these tactics, of just a success, if you can measure it in any conversation, which is to be put a stone in someone's shoe. Okay, so remember that phrase. And this actually, I think it rests, you find this idea actually in the passage from Paul in 1 Corinthians 3:6, where he's talking about baptism. He's talking, you know, I'm glad I didn't baptize many of you. But then at the end, he says, I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the increase. And many of you may have heard, you know, a phrase of, you got to plant that seed. And that's exactly what a Christian should aim to do. In any conversation, in any relationship, just plant that seed. Somebody else may come along when their heart, that skeptic's heart is ripe. Somebody else may come along and plant another seed. But all the while, you know, God is the one ultimately who gives that increase. God is ultimately the one. The Holy Spirit is the one who convicts the heart and turns their hearts from stone to flesh. Now, with that said, I must warn you that these tactics can be abused. Like, I can't say much more positive about these things, but it will be very tempting to use these for evil, right? I'm sounding like a superhero or something. I don't know. But they can be abused, right? When you learn these tactics and how to use them efficiently in a conversation, it's going to be very tempting to, if somebody's just bothering you, somebody's just pecking at you, and you just want to show your kind of rhetorical ability, and you just shut them down, but your heart is not in the right place, that's very tempting. Don't fall into that temptation. It is a disservice to the gospel. It is a disservice to our Savior Jesus. So pray that you don't enter into temptation, guys. Okay. That's the spiel. That's the intro. On to the tactics. All right, let's jump right in. You'll notice in your study guide, a lot of these have unique names. They're just kind of ways to help you remember them easily. So we're going to go through them, describe them, describe what they do, how to use them, give some examples of conversations, all right? This first tactic that we're going to go over, it's by far the easiest, all right? And it's going to be, it happens to be the most important. Now, before we learn about it, though, I want to show you how a conversation might play out in the street, in real life, okay? So at this moment, I'll call Matt up here. We're going to do a little skit for you guys. This is our little acting debut. Now, while we're doing this skit, we're going to go over two scenarios, okay? Two kinds of conversations that might pop up, two objections. I'll play the role of the skeptic. Matt is the awesome Christian. And while it's going on, I want you guys, when you're listening, I want you guys to first ask yourself, when I bring up the objection, how would I respond? I want you to ask yourself that. How would I respond to that? All right, imagine you have a very small window of opportunity. Also, pay attention to the responses that he gives, and then try to identify certain characteristics. What stands out about them? What makes them good to use? Okay? So, without any further ado, let's get this started. Hopefully I do well. All right. What's up, Matt? We've been talking for a while.
Yeah.
You know? I just got to ask you this. You know, who are we to say that Christianity is better than any other religion? You know, I just think that the essence of Jesus' teachings is just love. You know, I think every other religion teaches the same thing.
Let me ask you, Reuben, have you had an opportunity to study any other religions?
Well, not really. But I do have friends from other religions, and I see them all making an effort to love one another. I kind of see that same tie. And I think that's really what it's all about.
Well, I don't know if you've ever thought about it this way. Let's say a glass of water and a glass of rubbing alcohol. They kind of look similar on the surface. Maybe they have similar properties. You can, you know, pick one up. It's liquid. But I guarantee before you drink a glass of either, you'd want to know the differences. It's kind of a distinction you'd want to make. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've kind of ever thought about that. In comparison to like different religions, like maybe some of the differences?
I guess I haven't really. All right. So that's scenario number one. He brought up two responses, okay? So if you're jotting down notes, we'll get to that in a little bit. Here's scenario number two. All right. I'm still the skeptic.
So Reuben, do you believe a God exists?
You know, I don't actually. And it comes down to this. I just can't take things on faith, you know? You know, I need something more substantial. Personally, I look to science to understand the world around me.
Okay. Let me ask you, what do you mean by faith?
Well, I know I love this quote. It's by Mark Twain. You're familiar with him, I'm sure. And I think he put it best. He said, faith is believing what you know ain't so. So basically, believing something that you have no evidence for, or even when the evidence goes against it, that's faith. I can't deal with that.
That's really interesting. I'm a Christian, and you know the Bible, it does talk a lot about faith. Faith's used a lot in the Bible. Have you ever explored any of those passages and maybe just looked into its use and how it's used in the Bible?
Well, I guess not really.
Would you mind if I showed you just how it's used in its context?
Sure, I'm open.
Cool.
All right. So, scene. Now, we're starting with the first tactic. It's called the Columbo tactic, okay? Now, a few things to notice about the responses that were given and some of what I wrote down about what you guys said. Definitely this one right here. We noticed that right away, his first go-round is he's asking a question. And if you notice what the question really had to do with was defining the term, right? He said, what do you mean by faith? In that second one, right? What do you mean by faith? So he's defining a term, but he's doing it in a question form. Also, if you notice that these questions, they invited thoughtful dialogue. It wasn't like a sarcastic question or a rhetorical one that really didn't need an answer. The question actually was aimed at continuing the conversation, not stopping it. So I think that was really great. Also, the questions that he asked, if you notice, he was ultimately, if we kind of continued the conversation, his questions, his aim was actually trying to reach an end goal. So if you notice in the skit when he brought up the example about the water and rubbing alcohol, and then he asks a question for me to respond to, it seems he's kind of leading me somewhere, right? He's trying to set me up. So there's a purpose behind each question or each response that he gives, right? So these are the three main things that we should have recognized from the responses there. Now, you see, just like the skit, you know, especially in street evangelism, somebody's, you know, on their way to class, they're on their way to a meeting, they're trying to catch a bus, you have a very small window of opportunity, all right? This is what trips a lot of people up. We just get anxious, we get nervous, okay? He tells you, okay, he starts looking at his watch, okay, yeah, I got some time, you're just like, okay, what can I say? You know, it trips a lot of us up, all right? Now, this tactic, this Columbo tactic, it's perfect. It's the perfect tool to take advantage of that small window, okay? This is why it's known as the Columbo tactic. How many, and it's drawn from the TV show, the old TV show to me. How many of you remember watching Columbo? Who's familiar with the Columbo TV show? Yep, all the people with white hair. I'm just kidding. Okay. Nice. Yeah, Columbo was a detective show, and it was long running, and if I encourage you, go look it up on YouTube. Even, you know, I had to look it up on YouTube myself. I didn't grow up watching Columbo, but I was looked at it on YouTube, and it's amazing. This guy, it was really well written. It was cool. It was kind of corny, but if you notice what he does, is he's just kind of, he has this trench coat, right? He's got his little hat, and he's a detective, and he's got his little steno pad, and he's writing notes. But when he interviews suspects or whatever, and he's just kind of bumbling, you don't know, really kind of, he looks a little weird, and you're just standing there waiting to answer his questions, but he's like, now something just don't add up, you know? Let me ask you a question. And he'll ask, and then he's just gathering information, right? And then, okay, yeah, thank you, Detective Columbo, and he starts taking off, and then right as you think we're going to switch to another scene, he walks back, and he just opens the door. Just one more thing. One more question. I know I'm being a pest, but can I just ask you one more question? You know, and so, but that last question that he asks is really kind of like, it really makes the suspect jump, like, oh, he just caught me in a web of lies kind of stuff. But his way of gathering information was just asking, being persistent, and asking a whole bunch of questions, right? And that's really the beauty of this Columbo tactic. Columbo's method of investigating was asking questions. He had a kind of coy curiosity, and of course it's all built on that. Just one more thing, one more question, right? Advantages of this Columbo tactic: asking questions, all right? It's really what it is. Asking questions invites people to share their own ideas. It shows that you have an interest, a genuine interest in what the other person has to say. So I know many times, especially like when we're talking to family members, you know, when we get riled up, we just want to shut them down. We just want to show that they're dumb and they really have nothing of worth to say. And we might kind of say, oh, yeah, right, like I'll ever believe that. And we're kind of insulting them in the process, right? But this is the beauty of asking questions. And we'll see how that plays out. But it invites people to share their own ideas. I love talking. I'm sure you've gathered that so far. Every one of us, when we're asked questions, hey, how are you? Where are you from? We're doing that little small talk. It's awesome because we all love sharing about ourselves, you know? And that's, so keep them talking. Asking questions does that. Two advantages of asking questions is that you get an education in the process. So you leave the conversation knowing more than when you arrived. Sometimes, you know, a lot of people, I know I've asked people, hey, do you recommend a book on such and such topic? Or people have asked me, you know, where can I get some info on this? I think a good piece of advice would be, how about you just have a conversation with the person? Ask a bunch of questions. Get to know exactly what their viewpoint is. You can't get that in a book. It might give you a kind of a general overview, but this person might have deviations from whatever the book was talking about. They might not really be consistent. But the only way you're ever going to know that is if you have a conversation and you ask a whole bunch of questions, interview them, right? So you get an education. Also, another reason or advantage of the Columbo tactic is that questions allow you to advance the conversation without being pushy or preachy. How many of you have heard the complaint from skeptics? I don't like Christians because they're always trying to force their religion down my throat. They're very preachy. Whenever I see a person on the street, especially the ones with the bullhorns or the sandwich boards, they're very preachy, they're very pushy. They just want to force their beliefs in your face as I'm walking by. Well, asking questions, you know, genuine questions, is a way to avoid that. All right? So that's another advantage. Lastly, the last advantage here is that questions can put you, the Christian, in the driver's seat. As I mentioned, I've been repeating this, it puts you in control, ultimately, of the conversation. So once you're in control, you can steer wherever you want to go. You can control, you can guide it to where whatever end goal you have in mind. So those are advantages. Now we're going to get to what are the three basic ways that we can use this Columbo tactic. And we heard a couple of them. Actually, we heard them all in these two scenarios. All right. The first way that we can use this Columbo tactic, the first question that is really good to ask is, what do you mean by that? And you've heard me say this before. One of my favorite questions, if not my favorite, what do you mean by that? And the obligatory apology for my writing. First question. What do you mean by that? So we notice whenever I brought up my objection about faith and that I thought it was believing against the evidence, Matt's first question was, what do you mean by faith? What do you mean when you use the word faith? This is an excellent conversation starter, guys. So for those of you who may fear starting conversations, you know, if you hear a person kind of off, you know, in the same room, they're kind of bringing up objections. You're like, man, I really feel like I should say something to this person, but I don't know how to start it. I don't know what to say. This is a perfect question. You might lock on to a certain term that they're using over and over. It could be any term, really. Something you just genuinely want to know, what is it that trips them up about this certain topic? And just ask them, hey, what do you mean when you say this? What do you mean by that? Give me some reasons as to why you hold this belief, right? An advantage of this is that it gathers valuable information. You're able to gather information that you can use later on in the conversation. Also, you avoid, when you do that, when you gather information about them in their own words, you avoid distorting their view. A lot of times we're quick to assume whatever they mean by a certain term. So imagine if Matt just thought that when I use the word faith, that it was in the Christian sense, and we just kind of went through the conversation, we would just be talking past each other the entire time, and we wouldn't get anywhere. But he asked, what do you mean by faith? Oh, well, yeah, let me tell you. And then I know I've had this happen in First Thursday conversations with kids, and I said, so what do you mean by faith? I hear you using that term. Oh, yeah, believing what you know, and so blah, blah, blah. Oh, yeah, that's not what faith means. And so we go down that route. Yeah, can I show you in the Bible exactly, you know, how it's used? And yeah, they're eager and they're like, oh, okay. It's awesome. But it all starts, what do you mean by that? Now, when you're gathering information, you got to be patient, all right? So let's say you're able to sit down with this person. Gather that information. Be patient, all right? Be like a reporter. You know, don't get impatient and be like, oh, this conversation's got to end. It's going nowhere. No, just continue asking questions, and we're going to learn you can actually lead them somewhere ultimately, and hopefully you can persuade them to change their mind. So you got to be patient. You may have to use this question several times, and I hope you do. Use it often. Don't underestimate it, guys. It keeps the pressure off of you. That's a great thing about this. It keeps the pressure off of you, right? Matt didn't even defend a lot of what he believes. He's just asking me questions. He brought up an analogy, but to challenge me to defend my own view. He didn't have to defend a single thing that he believes. We hadn't even got to what Matt believes. That's another beauty of this question. So an example. You have a friend, and you ask him, hey, what do you believe? I'm an atheist. First question would be? What do you mean by that? I know atheists, some people really believe there is no God. But some people also believe that atheist means just a lack of belief in God. Just like a baby would have a lack of belief, or a cat would have a lack of belief. So there's two different definitions, but you would never know if you don't ask. What do you mean by atheist? Because I know there's different definitions floating around there, right? How about this example? You know, I'm spiritual, but not religious. I don't really like organized religion. What would you ask? What do you mean by religion? What do you mean by spiritual? How does that work? Let me get some information out of you. Good. All right, so that's the first question. What do you mean by that? Use it often. Be patient. Second question. Second way to use the Columbo tactic is, how did you come to that conclusion? So whereas the first question is really, hey, what do you believe? What is your stance? This one's more of, why do you believe it, right? How did you come to hold that certain belief that you're talking about? How did you come to that conclusion? This was used in the first scenario. When Matt's first question was, when I brought up, how can you say that one religion is just superior to any other religion? And right away he asked me, well, you know, I'm interested in, have you ever looked at what other religions teach? So basically he's asking me, it's a form of that question. He's asking me, why do you think that it's not, why do you hold that belief that it's not right to claim one religion superior to another? Have you actually looked into what these religions teach? How did you come to that conclusion? This is cool because it reverses the burden of proof, right? It's another way of keeping the pressure off of you. I don't have to defend a view of my own yet. I'm really making you defend your own view. Keeps the burden of proof on the skeptic. This is awesome. And it's really important that you understand that concept, guys, that the Christian is not the only person that has the responsibility to defend their view. We do. Peter tells us, always be ready to give a reason for the hope that is within us. But a lot of skeptics just walk around, you know, yelling out objections, and they think that, oh, the Christian is the one that has to defeat my views and defend his view, and I just have to sit here and ask questions all day long. No. The skeptic has the same burden of proof as you, but now, hopefully with this tactic, you can kind of keep it on them and try to catch them in an inconsistency, but you want to be in control of the conversation. Yeah, and this is awesome when you have this question in hand, because this means that you don't have to be an expert on every single subject. Remember, you're still gathering information. So you don't have to be an expert. You can become one if you ask enough questions, right? This is an awesome part of this question. And I would encourage you to do that. When somebody kind of brings up, they just sling a whole bunch of objections at you. Answer that, Mr. Christian. How do you respond to that? I got you in a corner now. Not really. You don't try to refute every single objection. This happens a lot on the internet, right? People, they start ranting and raving on the internet. You have this long diatribe. And a Christian might come like, oh, I'm angry. I really got to respond to that. And they try to answer, okay, point number one, you brought up this objection. Point number two, you brought up this. Don't do it. Just ask them a question. Make them defend their own view. Why do you hold this? Does it make sense? Now, these are some other ways of asking this second question, right? Like we brought up one in the first case. It was a variation of the why, or how did you come to believe that? Or how did you come to that conclusion? One would be, why do you say that? One other one would be, what are your reasons for holding that view? Or what makes you think that that's the right way to see it? And lastly, there's so many variations, but one last one that I'll add is, why would that idea seem compelling to you? And notice, this is not confrontational. You're genuinely asking. So you don't want to be a jerk about it and say, why would you believe that? You know, let your speech be with grace. Ask non-confrontationally. I'm really interested. Why would you hold that view? What are your reasons? Let's have a conversation. That's the second question. The third question, and it's really a type of question, and it's ask leading questions. Keyword being leading. Leading questions. And this was actually one of the observations that we noticed from the little skits that we did. Is that I remarked that Matt's responses, when he brought up the analogy, especially about the water and the rubbing alcohol, and they have similarities, but don't the differences matter, right? There was a purpose in asking that question. He was setting up himself to kind of be more in a better position, right? He was actually had an end goal in mind, but he started off with that one analogy and then the following question. And it could have gone on further, but this was a leading question. He started, okay, let me fish for a little bit of info. Let me see where he's at. If he says this, I'll go over here. If he says this, I'll go over here. It's a leading question. Leading questions can be used to inform. So maybe you have an idea that you want to indirectly kind of let the skeptic know. So this is actually, when you ask leading questions, whereas the first two were more defensive, right? You're keeping the burden of proof off of you. When you ask leading questions, is actually putting you more on the offensive side of things, right? Now you're starting to kind of give them your viewpoint for a purpose, right? So the first way that it can be used is to inform. So maybe you have an idea that you want to slip in there. Sometimes you want to indirectly explain your ideas. You know, well, have you ever considered it this way? And you give your belief, right? And notice it's not confrontational. Another way that this leading questions can be used is to set up an argument of your own. So sometimes you want to set up the terms of the conversation to put you in a more beneficial position. So just like he brought up the analogy, depending on what my answer was going to be, you know, he would have a response already in place. All right. So he's okay. I'm going to put myself in a position where I can kind of maybe catch him in an inconsistency here. Asking leading questions. Lastly, leading questions can be used to refute, just straight up refute an idea. So sometimes your questions will be aimed at just defeating a bad argument. Okay, so yeah, you can also use the phrase, you know, have you ever considered it this way? And at the same time, you're saying, it really doesn't pan out the way you think it does. All right? But you do it in a question form. You know, try to do that as much as possible. Put things in a question form. What's great about asking questions in these cases, the person you're speaking with will, you know, when you ask a series of questions to them, you don't move on to the next question until they agree with you, or they say, oh, they nod, and that's letting you know that they agree with this line of reasoning. Okay, let's proceed to the next question. So what's awesome about that is when you're asking leading questions, you have an end goal in mind. And so when you get up to that end goal, and if for some reason they disagree with the conclusion, you can say, well, this doesn't make sense to me. You know, like Columbo, right? Straighten this out for me. You agreed with me all the way through here, and the conclusion is this. Why wouldn't you accept it? Is there something else going on? All right, so that's the beauty, is that they would have agreed with you. You don't move on until they acknowledge that they understand you or they agree with you. This is crucial in persuading a person rather than just forcing your point of view, right? Rather than just kind of giving them a whole bunch of a big church history lesson or a big scientific lesson. No, you ask questions, they agree with you, you move on. And up to a point, you kind of put them wherever you want them, right? This is to control the conversation. Now, usually when using leading question, it requires, this is a big one, it requires that you have a certain knowledge in place. You have to have knowledge of where you want to go, first of all, right? And that's why this third part of the Columbo tactic, it's really the most difficult, because it just takes practice. It takes practice from, more being on the defensive side of things. You don't want to advance your own view yet. But then when you're ready, it takes a little kind of know-how. Okay, oh, I see what their fundamental objection is. I'm going to take them down this route. This is where I ultimately want to end. Now let me ask certain leading questions to get there. So it takes a little bit of cleverness almost. You know, you got to know where you want to go. And just like I... before we opened up the study, right, this is where having knowledge of theology comes into play. Somebody may have a mistaken view about the deity of Jesus. And so you're like, oh, that's the fundamental objection. Now, I don't want to force my opinion on them. I want to lead them to the truth. I want them to be persuaded. So I have an idea. I know how to defend the deity of Jesus, but let me do it in question form. Okay? So yeah, it does take some knowledge to do that. Yeah, like I said, this tactic does take time to develop, so don't be discouraged, guys. This is where I would encourage you to practice. Just like with anything, any new concept, you want to repeat it, get used to it, perfect it, and that way you can take it out to the streets and use it efficiently, okay? Remember, you don't need to hit a home run every single conversation. This is where the first two questions, What do you mean by that? And how did you come to that conclusion? These two questions are your best friend. If you're just learning about these tactics right now, those two questions are your best friend now. You can use that to start any conversation and really navigate a conversation just with those two questions if you're not ready to kind of ask the leading questions and be more on the offensive. So it's a great way to start. Everybody today now, just having these two questions in their pocket, can go out and start a conversation and have a good, productive, evangelistic conversation. You don't need to hit a home run every time. You just need to put a stone in their shoe. Ask good questions. Okay, the next tactic that we're going to look at is called the suicide tactic. And basically what you can use this tactic for these type of objections, self-destructing, or what we normally call self-refuting objections. Now, you probably have heard this term before, especially if you've been in the class, even when it began, because we actually went over this a concept of self-refuting views in the intro to logic class, when we went over logical fallacies. So if you're interested in learning more about those, kind of a little bit more in depth, let me know, and I can forward you the audio for that and the study guide for that study. But really quickly, self-destructing or self-refuting views, it's based on a rule of logic that a lot of you, I think everyone in here is implicitly familiar with, and it's called the law of non-contradiction. It basically says that A cannot equal not A, or the opposite of A, in the same sense and at the same time, right? So when you have two opposites, two opposing, literally two contradictory views cannot be true at the same time.
Can you give an example?
Yes. An example would be there is no truth. So if I'm let's play a little role play real quick. If I'm the skeptic and I say, "Yeah, you know, there's no truth." How would you respond?
Is that the truth?
Is that true? Yeah?
What do I mean by that,
right? That's good.
How did you come to that conclusion?
Exactly. You can lead up to it, right? Or have you ever considered it this way? You're dumb. That's good. Yeah, example, there is no truth, right? Well, is that statement true? Because if it were, then it's really just blowing itself up, right? It's suicide. It commits suicide on its own. It refutes itself. Basically, the claim, when it's applied to itself, it fails. It fails to live up to its own standards. Another example would be, what if I told you guys, I'm the skeptic, right? And I say, we really can't know anything about God. What would your response be there?
What do you mean by that?
Good.
We know that we can't know anything.
Say it again.
We know that we can't know anything.
Yeah, so there's actually one thing we can know about God, is that he's unknowable. How does that work? It doesn't live up to its own standard. All right? It commits suicide on itself. Does everybody get the basic premise there? Or maybe we can go over a couple more examples? I don't know. Does anybody have any questions about that one? Yeah, so whenever you want to learn to kind of look out for this, a lot of people really have self, especially the there is no truth or there are no absolutes. Is that absolutely true? You know, these are very common, especially on campus when we go out to First Thursday. So it'd be really awesome to train yourself to listen for these types of self-refuting views. So you want to pay attention to the basic idea, the basic premise or claim. Ask yourself, does the claim apply to itself? Does it live up to its own standards? All right? And then when you figure out, oh, this is actually a self-refuting view, kindly, gently point out the contradiction. Point it out with a question rather than a statement, right? So a version of the, why would you believe that? So, you know, clear this up for me. You know, help me understand what you're saying. You're saying that there is no truth. Well, is that true? Do you see the contradiction there? You know, is that one truth that I'm supposed to take from you? You know, so point it out with a question rather than just kind of flinging out a statement. So that's the suicide tactic. We gave a couple of examples, which I think are pretty prevalent. And then we also just went over quickly how to recognize a self-refuting view, okay? So that's the suicide tactic. The next tactic that we have is known as practical suicide. It's a little different than the suicide tactic proper, and this way it's different. Now, some beliefs that people hold may not be logically contradictory, so they can hold that belief. Like, I believe this, and it when you examine the statement, it's not really logically contradictory. But that belief can't be lived out. Okay? So an example would be, when somebody holds a belief, it's wrong to judge others. What's the problem there? Right? You're judging me for judging others. So that would be a great response. So would it be, don't you understand that you're judging me right now for judging others? Do you see an inconsistency there? So the belief that they have is not contradictory in and of itself. It's only when they say the statement. It's only when they actually try to say it and live it out that it becomes suicide practically. Another example would be, I'm sure a lot of us have heard this before. You know, you really shouldn't force your morality on other people. What's happening there?
They're forcing their morality.
Whenever you hear this key word, guys, or phrase, should or should not, that is letting you know, oh, they believe that everyone should abide by whatever comes after, should or should not. Keep that in mind. That should be on your radar. Listen out for should or should not. How about this? You know, I don't believe there's any free will. Everything is determined. If ultimately that's what it is, if that's reality, then there really is no right and wrong. If one person fizzes differently than I fizz, who's to call that wrong? Whenever you put two Coke cans, you shake them up, open it up. You're wrong, Pepsi. Dr. Pepper is right. You know, no. There's no free will there. So there's really no right and wrong ultimately. So practically, they can't live that out. So if there's no free will, well then what's the point of having this conversation? Ask them. So if there's no free will, then you were determined to say that, right? Well, yeah. So how are you even, what's the point of this conversation? Why are you getting so angry or whatever, Chris? Ultimately, if there's no free will, what's the point? All right? Do you guys understand? Any questions about that? Okay, so they can hold a belief. You can believe there's no free will all day long, but you just can't live it out, okay? That's practical suicide. So yeah, learn to kind of hear these claims, understand the basic premise, see where the flaw is, and then gently point it out to them, okay? That's practical suicide. Next tactic is sibling rivalry. This sibling rivalry, it's talking about objections when a person states a pair of objections. So they have two objections that they've brought up, but these two objections that they hold, these two beliefs that they hold, are logically inconsistent with each other. Basically, you brought up this objection earlier in the conversation, but now you're telling me this, which actually goes against what you said earlier. So it's like two siblings fighting against each other. This person cannot hold these two beliefs at the same time. They're logically inconsistent. So both objections cannot be simultaneously legitimate or true. An example of this would be, so check this out. A person, and maybe you've heard this or experienced this, a person may claim that good people go to heaven. All right? I think we've heard that a lot. Or they might ask why a certain good person is not allowed into heaven. So they have this concept of good, right? They're like, well, Gandhi was good. Why are you telling me that we're not going to see Gandhi in heaven? So they have this concept of good, okay? But if you dig a little deeper, by asking questions, you may find out that this person actually believes that good and evil are just relative. So earlier in the conversation, they just brought up the idea that they believe good people should go to heaven. So that let me know, okay, this person actually believes in good and evil, objective. There actually is good, is evil. But then over here, I asked some more clarifying questions, and now they're telling me that good and evil are relative. Well, how can I actually determine if Gandhi is good in the first place if good and evil are just relative? So you can learn to recognize that. Always try to listen out for these key phrases or key claims that they have. Kind of keep them in the back of your head. And then later on, oh, wait, you just said this earlier. now you're saying this, you know, just like Columbo, you got to help me straighten this out. You know, just one more question, you know?
You have to say it like that.
Yeah. How about this example? A common claim, of course, is that God has not done enough to remove evil from the world, right? We went over the problem of evil last year. God has not done enough to remove the evil from the world. But then you explain to them, well, in Christianity actually explains that God, there is actually coming a day where God is going to remove all evil from the world. In fact, he's going to destroy this world. He's ultimately going to judge everyone. All right? So, and evil is going to be removed. There's going to be a new heaven, new earth. There will be no more tears, no more sorrows. So you say, there really is no problem of evil. It just hasn't been removed yet. But then, they're quick to object with, well, I don't really like that God, because why would that God send a person to hell? You see that? They're over here claiming that God hasn't done enough to remove evil from the world. But then when you tell them what's going to happen, how God is actually going to do it, then all of a sudden God, they don't like the idea of God following through with his promises. You understand? It's inconsistent. You know, you're shifting the goalposts here. You know, nobody can satisfy you. Either you're going to be satisfied with the answer that what the Bible teaches, that God is actually going to do something about evil. But then over here you're complaining that, well, I don't like the way he actually handles evil in the first place. You know, you got to choose one. They can't both be true at the same time. So that's sibling rivalry. Two opposing claims can't be true at the same time. The next one is called infanticide.
Who came up with his name?
Greg Kokel, yes. Yeah, he's very morbid. No, I'm kidding, he's not. Infanticide. This occurs, or you can use this tactic whenever you hear an objection, or an objection is brought up, and this one's a little tough, but bear with me. An objection is brought up, and this objection is dependent upon a prior concept. Okay? I'm going to explain what we mean in a little bit. So the fundamental objection is what is called the child. All right? So I'll put a C and circle it. There's the child. That's the objection that they're bringing up. And the prior concept that we're talking about is the parent. Okay? So this child objection actually depends upon this prior concept, or the parent objection. Now, the twist is that the objection, the child one, can't be made unless this prior concept is true. But the prior concept is actually denied by this fundamental objection over here. All right, and I think it's better if I just give you an example. So remember the problem of evil. All right, many atheists hold that morality is objective. There really is good and there really is evil. Right? When they start using words like should and should not, they really believe that some things are good and they really believe that some things are evil. But then they say that because there's objective evil, that God cannot exist. Right? They say, well, if God exists, why is there so much evil in the world? Right? You might have heard that claim. So notice the two objections. One is that there is actually objective good and evil, and the other is that God does not exist as a result. But as we went over, if you remember in the problem of evil class, is the problem of evil, in order to have evil in the first place, you have to assume that God exists, because good and evil doesn't make sense unless you have this objective transcendent standard. So they're trying to deny God's existence through this objection of evil, but you actually have to assume God's existence in order to even have evil in the first place. But that's what they're trying to say, that God doesn't exist. All right, so it actually commits this, the very existence of this prior concept being true, commits infanticide against this child objection. All right, And honestly, I think this example, the problem of evil, that's really the only objection that applies to this infanticide topic. So you really just have to remember, oh, actually, you need to assume God's existence in order to have good, objective good and evil in the first place. So I encourage you, go listen to that problem of evil study, get familiar with those arguments, and you'll be able to gently guide them toward the truth. Remember, using questions. Use leading questions and try to clarify terms and stuff like that. All right, good stuff, guys. The next one, next tactic is taking the roof off. Taking the roof off, not raising the roof. Although you would take the roof off if you did that. And really, this is based on the premise that you think of an argument like a house. You know, you have a foundation, you have walls that are supporting your conclusion, which is the roof. All right? So if you're basically you're reducing, taking the roof off tactic is saying that your conclusion, if I follow your line of thought to its logical conclusion, your conclusion is absurd. Basically, I'm saying your roof is dumb. It doesn't belong here. Your conclusion is wrong. If I follow it. And another way to think about it is think about worldviews or think about kind of sets of beliefs like maps. All right. So you're for the sake of argument, you're putting yourself in the skeptic's shoes. Right. This is the way to handle this tactic. Listen to the fundamental claim from the skeptic. All right. And then, okay. The fundamental claim is this, if I'm hearing you correctly. All right, well, let's follow this line of thought to its logical conclusion, okay? Now, just like a map, if you wind up in a weird destination, then you know your map is wrong or part of the map is wrong. So you got to kind of backtrack and say, okay, where did we veer off? What wrong turn did I take? What belief is wrong here that led me to this absurd conclusion? And we actually studied this fallacy in the Intro to Logic class. It's known as reductio ad absurdum, which just means reducing an argument to absurdity. You're saying to the skeptic, your conclusion is absurd because if I live out your beliefs, it's like kind of a slippery slope. It doesn't lead to a good place. It doesn't lead where you think it's leading. All right. But yeah, the steps is you adopt their viewpoint for the sake of argument. Put yourself in their shoe. Give their ideas a test drive. Okay, if I hold this belief, this implies that this is going to happen, or I have to believe this as well. And then also that belief leads to this belief. And I actually wind up in a very bad place where I don't want to be. It doesn't make sense. And so you can let the skeptic know, does this make sense to you? Do you understand how I got there? You know, what do you think about that, right? So hopefully once you point out to the skeptic, this is where your beliefs lead. You know, would you consider maybe changing some other fundamental beliefs that you may have? You know, ultimately, we're both trying to arrive at truth, right? So do it in a non-confrontational way. An example of this would be moral relativists. So people who believe that morals are relative, there really is no objective good or evil, right or wrong. They want to affirm that morals are relative, so they'll say all day long, oh yeah, morality is relative. There really is no good, there really is no evil. And this actually happened with a conversation we had on First Thursday. It was, I think he was German, right? He sounded German. But he kept saying over and over, morals are relative, yeah. There really is no good, there really is no evil. And I asked the guy, what if society wanted to make murder legal? He believed morals were just a social construct, right? It's just based on whatever the majority of people believe. I asked him, what if society wanted to make murder legal? What would you do as a moral relativist? It's a leading question, right? I'm kind of setting him up. And he answered, well, I would call my friends and I would ask them to join me in petitioning against it. And I responded, well, think about it this way, right? Why would you try to impose your morality on them? Why not respect that morality is relative? Because ultimately, right, he's trying to use the word should. He's saying, oh, I believe that murder should be wrong for everyone. That's why I'm going to go and call up my friends to help me petition. So he's imposing his morality. So he actually believes that there is actually objective evil. Murder should be wrong for everyone in every time in every place. But if he really believed what he was saying, that morals are relative, why would anyone bother contacting anybody else? You're going against your own worldview. Unfortunately, he had to go, but he wasn't getting the concept. There was a kind of maybe lost in translation type thing, but yeah. That's a good example there. Moral relativists are comfortable saying, oh, I'm a relativist all day long. But you start seeing the inconsistency when they try to impose morality, objective morality on others. All right. And we also see the same thing. Jesus actually did this in Matthew chapter 12. Whenever the Pharisees were claiming that he was casting out demons by the power of Satan. And right, he's like, why would Satan cast out his own demons? It doesn't make sense, you know? So he pointed out the contradiction in their beliefs there. Took the roof off. Can you imagine Jesus? Hey, Pharisees. You're wrong. All right. This is the last tactic, guys. It's known as the steamroller. Steamroller. Picture, you know, those big machines with a big cylinder, and they just kind of roll over anything. They flatten everything they go over, right? This represents an overconfident, overbearing, and overwhelming person. I'm sure maybe some of us have been approached by somebody like that or have a conversation with somebody like that. Their challenges come quickly, one after another, just like, rah, 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 rah. They constantly interrupt you when you're trying to answer them. As soon as you begin to answer them, they hear something they don't like in your explanation, they interrupt you once more, and then they actually change the subject. They pile on another challenge for you to answer. If you go down that path, they interrupt again, and then they change the subject once again. So they're never really listening genuinely to anything you have to say, so you're always on the defensive, and you might be caught off balance. You're like, man, where's this guy, and he's spitting in my face. He's like, come on. Right? This is a steamroller type person. How do we handle a person like that? Yeah, you guys are in a splash zone. So how do we handle a steamroller? And it needs a little bit of courage from the you guys, from the Christian, because they are aggressive, an aggressive person, they have to be handled aggressively. Otherwise, they won't get the point. But you can do it in such a way where you're not rude. All right? The first step is a mild step. All right? It kind of builds up. There's three steps. The first step is mild. Basically, you just want to request courtesy from them. So you pause the conversation whenever they're done with their monologue or whatever. You pause the conversation, and then you want to ask them for permission to continue without being interrupted. You're like, well, you know what? Let's pause. You know, time out, kinkies, whatever you want to say. Can, I want to respond to you. Can I continue without you interrupting me? I really want to get this idea out, okay? So, yeah, you can ask them, is it okay with you if I take a few moments to answer your question before you ask another? All right, it's non-confrontational, very mild. You just request courtesy from them. Now, the second step, you want to use this one when the person violates the first request for courtesy, right? Let's say that, okay, yeah, you can respond to my objection, but then they interrupt you again. Well, the second step is a little bit more, less mild, I guess. It's a little bit more aggressive. And here you want to directly, it's kind of, you shame them, okay? You directly point out their rudeness or their bad manners. You can also use their name, right? Because when you use your name, it's almost like mom calling you by your full name. You're shamed. And you ignore any new objections that they bring up. You know, don't even go down any rabbit trails. Just stop the conversation and ask them, hey, so-and-so, can I ask a favor of you? I'd love to respond to your concern, but you keep breaking in. Could I have a few moments without you cutting off, you know, my train of thought so I can develop my point? Then you can tell me what you think. Cool? So I use their name. I pointed out that they're being rude. And then I ask them for courtesy once more. So hopefully that'll do it if they're reasonable. But a steamroller sometimes keeps going and going, right? So step three is the most aggressive. And here is when all else fails, you've tried stopping them, you've tried shaming them. If those two don't work, then ultimately leave them. Leave them, walk away. Not everyone, this is based on the premise that not everyone deserves an answer. And you might be familiar with this passage in the New Testament. Jesus told his disciples in Matthew chapter 7, verse 6, don't cast your pearls before swine, lest or in fear of if they trample you under their feet and turn and tear you into pieces. So this is actually talking about a steamroller. You know, not everyone deserves an answer. If you see that they're not even paying attention to what you say anyways, why continue the conversation? It's they're not ready to engage in that conversation, so just stop it. Okay, hey, have a good day. Shake their hand. It's clear. It's clear that you don't want to have a genuine conversation, so I'm just going to stop it here. Okay, have a good day. That's about it. So yeah, it takes a little bit of courage, but this is sometimes what it takes. Okay, and it's awesome because this works great, especially if people are around you, right? So maybe you're not doing it more for them; you're doing it more for the people around. Now it's a catch-22 sometimes because sometimes you'll feel the need to continue the conversation, even if this person's trying to steamroll you, for the benefit of people around you. So you're not really, you know, this guy's not listening, but you're trying to give the best answers you can so that people around you will be like, oh, okay, he brings up a good point, blah, blah. And that guy's a jerk. He really is not speaking the truth, right? So sometimes you'll want to continue that. But at other times, you'll want to stop it and for the benefit of others. So the Christian, you'll be like, oh, I guess all Christians aren't jerks, you know? Use your discernment there, okay? That is how you handle a steamroller, guys. Now, I left a couple of the tactics out. You can find them in the book. But I believe that this set that we just went over, they're definitely a great starting point, and they cover the majority of types of objections that you'll come across. Lastly, a quick note on improving your use of these tactics that we went over. So sitting through this class and writing down some notes does not guarantee that anything will be different in your conversations. It does not guarantee it. Why? Because it's up to you now. You are the one that has to put it into practice. That means you have to actually go out and have a conversation in order to apply these tactics, right? I like this this quote that was found in the book, and I think he's actually referencing maybe a common saying in the Marines or in the Navy. And for you Marines or Navy people, you can tell me if this is true. The more you sweat in training, the less you bleed in battle. True?
I wasn't a Marine. Ah.
The more you sweat in training, the less you bleed in battle.
Makes sense, though.
It makes sense, right? So basically, it takes practice, guys. You want to get familiar with these tactics, learn them, practice even in the comfort of your own home with friends. I encourage you guys to go start groups. You know, hey, I really want to practice. You know, I really have a desire to get into conversations. Can I practice with you? You know, start meeting up once a week, stuff like that. If you really want to get good at this. Seek out opportunities to have conversations with friends and strangers. That's the only way it's ever going to happen. Now, also, don't lose heart if skeptics get the best of you sometimes, okay? Don't be discouraged by this. If you're just starting out, it's going to happen, okay? That's just the nature of the game. It is not for us, this is a quote, it is not for us to calculate our victory or fear our defeat, but to do our duty and leave the rest in God's hands. That's ultimately the Christian's objective. Also, another quote, we should measure our legitimacy by our faithfulness and obedience to Christ. He alone will bring the increase. Success is not measured by numbers or impact, but our fidelity to our Savior. Remember that. So study these tactics, learn how they work. They're going to work very well for you, I promise you. Know the truth, know your Bible, push yourself beyond your comfort zone. All right?